So these are preliminary results. When it comes to PDA and exploration of the scenarios, there are a large number of scenarios that you can explore. And we are developing a tool that is going to help us to develop and make real-time changes and see how that changes the results. And so again, the recap, we depart from a demographic model. We use regressions between vital rates of that model and Chinook abundance. Perturbation analysis to identify those interactions that we want to explore within a PBA framework, right? So these selected fishing scenarios, this is another way of presenting it. From the perturbation analysis, we get two important items. We get the identification of relevant fishing scenarios. From the transient dynamics, we get kind of reasonable minimum time horizons for PBAs, right? And then we incorporate other things like the effect of demographic stochasticity, the effect of environmental stochasticity, and we incorporate, of course, information on recovery goals, right? That we know that for the U.S., we've been talking about a 2.3% annual increase for 14 years for downlisting. The Canadian recovery goal in terms of demographics is it will be something like a population goal, just greater than one. And so this is going to help us to identify what is the influence of Chinook abundance on the extinction and recovery probabilities of these two killer whale populations. So the objectives of the PBA for these selected fishing scenarios, if you remember from one of the previous talks, that we selected those with the greatest elasticities, the greatest effects in the past, trying to maximize the effects. And the idea behind that step is that we already know that the effect on population growth is small. So we say, okay, let's analyze, let's focus on the worst case scenarios here, right? So for the north, for the northern residents, we ask a different question. We ask, what will it take to actually stop population growth rate? And that's a little bit off topic here, so it's not going to be in this presentation, but we are working on that as well. So these are the selected fishing scenarios. We have four scenarios, and the first scenario is just as a reference, right? It is the status quo without any kind of fisheries information, right? It's not targeting any vital rate. The scenario two corresponds to hypothesis 1A, basically the one for which we can invoke causation, right? And the objective is recovery. And the characteristics of this scenario is the maximization of Fraser Area and Puget Sound terminal run. And how do we achieve that? Well, no ocean fishing on these two stocks, right? So that will be the maximum effect. And this is going to produce a substantial increase in fecundity of all reproductive females. And we are going to see this increase actually accounts when it comes to population viability. The scenario number three, corresponds to hypothesis 2A, for which we cannot invoke causation now, right? Or it can point us towards additional research. The objective is recovery, and is the maximization of WCBI terminal run, no ocean fishing on WCBI. And in this case, we have also an increase in the survival rates of the productive fields. Now, the final scenario corresponds to hypothesis 2A, recovery. And in this case, the maximization, in this case, that was an iterative process. We changed values until we maximized the survival of young and old reproductive females. And this took place when we increased the ocean harvest rates of Puget Sound by 75%. So these are the scenarios, right? And for this particular scenario, which we are saying, okay, what is going to happen if we don't have ocean fishing on, what is the effect of no ocean fishing on the terminal run of Fraser Area and Puget Sound stocks? Well, we need to make some kind of conversion there because we know that not all the fish caught in fisheries are mature, right? So we use this concept of a terminal run equivalence, which is basically just the product of catch by maturation rates, by age, right, on all preterminal fisheries. And that allows to have an idea what is the actual effect of any changes in ocean fishing on the terminal runs. So, and here are only some clarification notes. I mean, there are some misunderstandings of what are the purposes of PBAs or what really PBAs are showing, right? So one of the first things is that PBAs are not a forecast, right? They never were attempted to be a forecast. They are exploratory tools, right? And so everything that comes within a PBA analysis allows us to focus on the relative difference between management scenarios rather than focusing on the absolutes. We are not including environmental trends like climate change or catastrophes. Genetic factors are not incorporated, or other things that we know that are actually going to decrease population viability. So that we know that the direction we incorporate this kind of thing, most likely we're going to have a decrease in whatever probability we estimate. Now the magnitude, and we're also assuming that the magnitude and the variation in the vital rates observed in the past, remember that we are focusing on this 87-2011 period, is going to be representative of the future before perturbations, right? The viability criteria that we're going to use here are not written in stone. I mean, if we go to the criteria that the IUCN or COSIWIC in Canada uses and other entities, well, you have time horizons of 100 years, 250 years, 40 generations, right? And you have reference to 95 probabilities of extinction, 95% probability of extinction, 99%. So this can change, right? But again, the idea is to gain information on how different management approaches are going to change the relative differences on population viability. The analysis that we are presenting here also is not accounting in trends in ocean harvest rates for the reason that we don't know that this trend is going to continue, right? Here I'm just presenting the harvest rates for those particular stocks or stock aggregates and coastwide that we found had some kind of interaction with vital rates and an effect on population growth rates, right? So there is a clear decline there. We are using all of that information, but we are not projecting that that trend is going to continue. So this is the status quo when it comes to projections of population size in an IID environment, basically saying that the magnitude of variation in the past corresponds to what is going to be in the future. So we see that at 10 years in the future, it's an identically and independently distributed environment. So in 10 years, right, the mean population size projected for the southern residences is 82 individuals, 76 at 20 years, 69 at 30, and 63 at 40, right? And also notice that the numbers of years in the x-axis are different in each one of these. And so we remember a result from our transient dynamic analysis that 35 years should be the minimum used for this kind of projection, just to give enough time for the transient dynamics to subside. So continue with the status quo. We explore the probability of US downlisting, right? And which is almost equivalent to 120 individuals in the future, and that comes from these simple computations that if we have a US recovery target of 2.3% per year for 14 years, and we use the initial population size of 87, it will give us a number of 120 individuals. And we use that as our population threshold to estimate the probabilities of reaching that kind of target. Now, this kind of IID environment stochastic projections gave us a zero probability of reaching that number in 14 years. I'm not showing a plot there because it's just a flat line, right? And we allow that to continue for 100, for 200 years, and still the probability remains zero. That's under the status quo conditions. Now, if we just choose an arbitrary population threshold, let's say 30 individuals, because we know that recovery is not feasible under those conditions, well, what are the probabilities of extinction or quasi-extinction, right? So here we are using the same kind of a simulation environment, right? And we can see that after 80 years, still the probability of falling below 30 is zero, but as soon as you reach 80 years, that increases rapidly, right? And this is without incorporation of any kind of demographic stochasticity. Now, when we remove environmental stochasticity and we just allow demographic stochasticity to play a role, basically we are drawing each individual, each survivor from a binomial distribution and each new individual from a Poisson distribution. So we see how, just by chance, right, and the small size of this population is allowing for a large effect on demographic stochasticity. And if we compare this with the plot that we see that we saw before, it is even before 60 years, 80 years, that we have already, some of these trajectories are falling below 30 individuals before the 80 years mark that we saw in the previous plot. Now, and just for comparison, I included this here with the northern residents, in which population size is still small, but the effect of demographic stochasticity, not even by chance, produces a negative trajectory like in the case of the southern residents. Now, we want to be more thorough and say, okay, let's incorporate the effect of both environmental stochasticity and demographic stochasticity. I'm including that other plot there just for comparison. But when we incorporate and when we allow demographic stochasticity to play a role as well, we see that the probability of falling below 30 is greater than zero, even at 10 years, right, in the future. So this is telling us that it's really important to incorporate demographic stochasticity in our projections, especially for the southern resident killer wave. What is here? That median value that is there, the 47.1, is just indicating that that's the number of years that it's going to take to have a 0.5 probability of quasi-extinction. Now, if we, instead of using a single threshold of 30, we use, a continuous, right, from 0 to 100, well, obviously, the probability being under 100 is going to be 1 because it's already lower than 100 individuals, right? And as we move from right to left, we see how the probability of the population following below a particular threshold decreases to the point in which we have zero abundance, and then we have our extinction risk. That would be the absolute extinction risk. And there is a probability of almost 0.5, right, under the status quo conditions. And again, some of you now will be thinking, why is this so different to what Eric presented? Well, there are various reasons, and of course, this will be the material for a good discussion. But one reason is also that we are using a different time period that we already know that has a potential population growth that is lower, right? Now, we did exactly the same with each one of those four scenarios, right? I only show you the analysis that we kind of explore during this phase of our investigation, and we did exactly the same with the other scenarios. And here, we are selecting some metrics of comparison, right? As I said before, this is an ongoing investigation, and we can incorporate other viability criteria. So for the third column, we have the stochastic population growth there, right? And we can see how that changes between scenarios. I just inserted again those scenarios at the bottom so that we remember what those scenarios refer to, right? But what this is saying is that for hypothesis 1A, which is the hypothesis for which we can invoke causation, right? Which is the maximization of Fraser-Ellie and Puget Sound terminal runs, right? We can see that the change in population growth rate is minimum, right? It's a very mild effect, even that we are maximizing the effect there. The mean abundance in 20 years is going to be the same with or without this fission scenario. The extinction probability is a little bit lower, right? And the probability of downlisting, again, using this quantitative criteria from the US, is zero, right? And that probability remains zero for all those four scenarios. It is important to indicate here, for example, that for scenario four, in which we are exploring 75% reductions on the hardware rate for billet sound, we actually produce a positive population growth rate there. And so, but that's a very large, I mean, this is an extreme scenario that we are exploring, right? Here, the probability of extinction is about half of what it is under status quo conditions, but still the probability of downlisting remains zero. So as a form of conclusions here, so we found that there is a negligible effect on population growth and recovery probabilities from the interaction between Fraser Valley Puget Sound terminal run and the southern resident vital rates, right? Which is the hypothesis for which we have some kind of evidence. For hypothesis 2A, for WCBI, I mean, yeah, we talk about it. I mean, what is the is it possible that the southern residents are preying on WCBI stocks in the terminal areas? Yeah, it's possible. We know that the whales they explore and they certainly go to those areas, and but we don't have enough information, and that's why WCBI is, belongs to hypothesis 2A, right? Because we don't have enough support. But we can see that even without ocean fishing on these stocks, there is a very small increase in population growth that actually is still below one. Now for this other scenario, which this is more likely, right? I mean, Puget Sound stocks are captured by trout fisheries during the winter just of WCBI, and so basically within the range of the southern resident killer whales. And this is, I mean, it's feasible, right? But this extreme reduction on ocean harvest produces allows for a positive population growth rate that is not that relevant. Right? And even under this extreme scenario, there is a zero probability of meeting those specified downlisting recovery targets. So we have some material in our hands now, I mean, some evidence from all this analysis that give us an opportunity to answer to this question, right? Is Chinook abundance limiting the population growth and viability of resident killer whales? Right? And that's one of the main questions that have triggered this series of workshops. Right? And so let's start just by discussing some of the signals in the northern resident. Well, we know that there is broader and stronger response in the northern of the northern resident killer whales vital rates to Chinook salmon abundance. We saw that yesterday as well. But still, there is no evidence that the levels of Chinook abundance are limiting this population growth of this one, because they are still in a growing mode, right? And there is no hint that population growth is going to stop soon. It has to stop at some point, right? So we also found weak interactions between southern resident vital rates and Chinook salmon abundance. And here we have at least a couple of hypotheses that other factors could be at play limiting population growth other than the abundance of Chinook salmon, or that those other factors are actually masking predator-prey dynamics. Demographic stochasticity is already an issue for the southern residents, and this has been demonstrated here. And of course, the smaller the population size is, there is not only increasing the effect of demographic stochasticity, but a high risk of inbreeding depression, right? And possible disruption of mating behavior, trying to avoid inbreeding. So do these results support adjustment to fisheries? Well, from hypothesis 1A, no, because there are negligible effects on recovery, right? From hypothesis 2A, possibly, because we saw that extreme scenarios can actually exert positive population growth. Well, remember that the caveat in this second hypothesis is that we are assuming that Chinook salmon is still an important prey item year-round. Right? So we need additional research. Well, at least, I mean, there is a possibility. It's a possibility, and I think that this highlights the importance of continuing investigating this. So some of the things that this investigation support are that we need additional research to identify the causes for depressed cal survival and fecundity in southern Brazil, we found that that was the some of the few demographic difference with the northern residents, right? And of course supports the continuation of the studies of diet composition in the fall, in the winter and spring that can verify those interactions that this investigation is uncovering, right? And that we can move beyond potentially spurious correlations or invoke cause-effect interpretations. And so as I say, we are working just on compiling all this analysis into a single platform, allowing us to be very efficient, incorporating new information, new data, new viability criteria, rapid explorations of fishing scenarios. And there is going to be a first report available in February, and hopefully we manage to publish at least a couple of publications. So that's it.
Questions from the panel?
Clearly very different results than Eric's. Do you have any feeling at the moment for how much is just due to the basic issue of where you start the data series? So he ends up with almost all of his probability space with positive growth rates, and you end up with a median growth rate slightly negative.
I think it's a time period, right? That we demonstrated that in the last 25 years, the population is not effectively growing, right? I think that the two pieces of information are important because in one, you are including a larger time series that has the caveat of a deterioration of data quality in the early years, and in my approach, you have the caveat that we are using a portion of the data available there. Right? So I believe that the main difference in terms of those probabilities and population growth rates are due to the time period. But our results concur in the sense that the effects of Chinook abundance and, for that matter, fishing is very negligible on the population variability of the tier rates.
Well, I mean, certainly the extinction risks are pretty sensitive.
That's true. Yeah, I think that you have to consider that information. We cannot disregard it. Because definitely the population, I mean, southern residents, they are a very small population size. And just by the stochastic processes, the probability of extinction is going to be greater than zero just because of the population size.
I'd like to better understand how you handled stochasticity. What were you sampling from? To return to my question from yesterday.
Yes.
And those regressions, you have a pooled error term that has several sources of variance and error mixed up.
Yes.
Basically, where do your distributions come from?
Yes. In this case, we are generating a large number of matrices, right? And in each matrix, the vital rates are extracted from the distributions, right?
Where do the distributions come from?
Sorry?
Where do the distributions of the vital rates come from?
Yes, yes. For the survival, we use a beta distribution, and for fecundity, we use a log normal distribution. And we explore also the beta because in most cases, fecundity is less than one.
Right? No, I understand that. I'm not making my question clear. You have to have those distributions have shape parameters that presumably are based on data.
Yes, of course.
I see. Where do those distributions go?
Yes, the mean and variance comes from the mean and variance for the vital rates on the 87-2011 time period.
And that was some sort of a mark recapture analysis then, or a fit to the time
that comes from census data, right?
Yeah,
all the vital rates come from census data, so you can estimate fecundity rates every year, right? And then you can estimate the temporal variance on those on fecundity or on survival rates, for that matter.
So basically, what you're doing is are you pooling across? Are you preserving the individuals in that analysis? Or are you simply saying we've got n at t plus one, and the survival rate is the quotient? I mean, how are you estimating those? How are you estimating fecundity and survival from the time series?
Well, Well, I think that I showed that in the first presentation. Survival, for example, is estimated as the number of individuals within in a given year, right? Within a life stage, the number individual is the number of individuals in year T plus one divided by the number of individuals in that stage at year T. And the fecundity is estimated as the number of calves, viable calves, in this case, because we don't know much about the survival probabilities during the first 6 months of their lives. And so by that, the number of live, viable, the number of viable calves by females in a life stage by year.
Okay.
Yeah, I agree with Ray that, you know, this is the complete opposite of what Eric just showed. And, I mean, you're discussing the effects of changes in fisheries that are having trivial effects on the outcome when your choice of the starting, presumably, the starting values for the analysis is completely, I mean, they're going to go extinct. According to your analysis, right?
Yeah, I mean, a population cannot have large probabilities of remaining or being viable with those numbers and with the population growth that we have in the last 25 years.
So why didn't you look at how the effect of different choices of data series affects
whether
they're going to go extinct or they're going to grow?
Yeah, we can do that. We can do that. But coming back, for example, to the question that you made yesterday, I think so, that what is a quantitative criteria to select the right time series? Well, what was the right quantitative criteria to choose any other time series? There is not such quantitative criteria, right? You have to use some kind of, I mean, to take a decision, right? You have to call the shots there and say, you know, based on this, I want my time series to represent this kind of data. But there is no better or best time series that you can select, right? I explained that there were a number of criteria that help us to select the time series that we wanted to use, because we wanted to make projections based on demographic rates, and the demographic rates on the last 25 years are more representative of what of the status of the population now, that you include information on demographic rates for which there is lots of uncertainty. The time series that we choose, all the survival rates, all the fecundity rates, we have a strong confidence on those numbers because they come from very good census data, right? We don't need to make reconstructions of time series. Whether you use the earlier time, the earlier use of the time series, you have to use a number of assumptions that were made, actually, right? To generate, to fill the gaps in information. Some of the assumptions were that the survival rates of individuals were constant, which we know is not true. They also mentioned that the age at first maturity was constant, and another kind of assumptions, right? But I think that your use of the word is contrary or opposed to what Eric found. I don't think that's the case. I mean, we found that the effect of fisheries, right, is going to be small on population variability.
But that's not what Eric found.
I think that that's what he found on this end. I don't know, Eric, was that what you found, that the effect of even large effects on changes in Chinook salmon abundance are going to have small effect on viability?
I wasn't really looking at viability because the posteriors were so much greater than zero. Mm. Extinction is just not an interesting problem if it never happens. And so I was more interested in how it would change probabilities of meeting recovery goals or mean population size, things like that.
Yeah, and you can do that when you have the kind of positive population growth rate that you have. But when you have a slightly declining, like the one that I had, scenarios to explore recovery are reduced, because that will only happen when you reduce really, really substantially. Right? And that's what happened here, that when you reduce Puget Sound, ocean abundance, the harvest rate, sorry, by 75%, then you get a positive population growth rate, and you can talk about probability of reaching a given threshold.
Right?
quick clarification. One of the things you just said, I think, in your response to Sean was that there's some uncertainty early in the time series. And I was hoping you could elaborate on that a little bit more, because everything that I'm under the impression of is that, you know, starting in 1979 or so, the Southern residents were essentially censused, and we know births and deaths essentially perfectly from that point forward. The ages are uncertain, and that may or may not introduce bias. I would argue that with the state structure model, it probably won't, because your uncertainty is really, is an animal old or young? It's not, is the animal 30 or 40? So I was just hoping you could talk about that early part of the time series, what you think is uncertain.
Yeah, all of that comes from reading the paper from Peter Olesik, who, I mean, thanks to his work, we were able to actually populate the time series of abundance and age specific information for the earlier years. Right? And when you read carefully that document, you realize all the number of assumptions that were made. Right? So the way we saw it is that, okay, we are going to use a demographic model, right? I mean, that's a small difference with your approach, that it's more like an individual-based approach. Right? In this case, it's a demographic life stage model. So we considered that we wanted individual information of a high quality, right? And at least to have 25 years, which is a generation time. Right? So yeah, I think that yes, there is an important call there for the panel to make a decision. I mean, what kind of information is considered and what is not considered, right? But I mean, this information is relevant and is based on a thorough analysis. And as I said, it's not the end of the story. We are still working on this, and we can change and we can follow something like that. So what happened? Because now we have part of this tool that is mentioned here. It's completed. Now it's going to be easier for us to incorporate new data, right? And we can do something like that. So how that changes if we incorporate more years? If we are focusing on the absolute differences in viability, then I don't think that's going to be a very productive exercise. But if we try to focus, what are the relative changes under different management scenarios, I think that that can be important.
I'm curious about how much of the difference between your analysis and Eric's may be due to differences in your estimates of the vital rates. The strength of this data set is that all of the individuals are known and can be their position marked and followed over time. And maybe I'm misunderstanding, but when you calculated survival, you simply pooled. You didn't preserve any of the individual identities as Eric did in his logistic analysis, where essentially it's 0-1 data for survival.
Yes, yes.
And so I guess one of the things I'd be interested in is how different is your estimate of the mean and variance of survival from the logistic approach that Eric used, because that could cause enormous difference in the analysis. And I, you know, my personal view is that you're throwing away information when you lose this individual structure through time, which is sort of the gold standard of estimation of vital rates. So I'd be really interested in knowing that beta distribution for survivals, what are the mean and variance in your case and in Eric's case?
Well,
I bet they're different.
No, that's a great point, because you have identified a very important issue, which is one of the premises of a stage structure models is that all individuals within a stage are identical, right? And you have identified that, and so that's very important. But when we make the comparison to the age structure model, right, when you have that kind of aggregation kind of diminished, right, then you still have the same results when it comes to population growth rates, right? So we have the results for the age structure model, and they are basically the same. So they are not as optimistic as when you use the whole time series, right?
No. The panel's mostly covered essentially what I was going to bring up, which is the point that most of the results you saw from Antonio's work, I think, was driven by the fact that he started with a lambda that was less than one, and so it had to be driven to extinction without some major jerking around the fisheries. And that, of course, was driven by the set of years that were used to generate that lambda. So essentially what I was going to say was basically echoing what some of the people in the panel said, that would help look at other lengths of the entire time series or other sets of years, because that's going to be very influential on what that estimate of lambda is.
Yeah, and I think, and if I just can just add a little bit, I mean, all of this comes back to the original question that we had in mind, right? I mean, what we wanted to explore is, I mean, what is the influence, right, of Chinook abundance on the viability? And even we are moving, like, in different regions of the viability, we are still finding the same, right? What Eric found and what I found, what we found, is that the effect of changes in fisheries is expected to have very, very minor effects on the viability, whether you are here in the negative region or in the positive region.
I think we're looking at two different things. You're looking at what is the effect of these different actions on the trajectory of the population, let's say, or I think a lot of people that look at this information, though, won't be looking at that. They'll be looking at the direction that the population's going. And so I understand what you're saying is, what is the incremental effect of whatever you're doing on what's happening?
Yeah.
But most people that look at this aren't going to be doing that. They're going to be looking at, is the population going up or is it going down? So I think it would be good to try to nail down both of those things.
Yeah, I think that the two arguments are, it has to be accounted, right? Because you cannot disregard the fact that the population hasn't been effectively growing during the last 25 years. So okay, what you have to consider all the information that is there.
Yes, I was going to comment that I think the hypothesis approach that you took to evaluating fishing scenarios is really interesting. I don't know that I was really clear on the different scenarios that you considered, one of which was West Coast, Vancouver Island. I think you mentioned stocks. Was that stocks or is that catch in the West Coast, Vancouver Island area for the index?
Yeah, it's an aggregate of stocks.
Aggregate of stocks. Yeah. So you're saying that scenario is representing no catch in the WCVI catch area?
Yeah, Chuck, you have a comment there?
I think Allison's asking a different question. I think she's asking, what you have is WCVI, is that the aggregate of stocks of the WCVI ABBM, or is it the aggregate of the little rivers that make up the WCVI stock?
Yeah, the second one, because we're dealing with terminal runs here. WCVI terminal run.
Okay. So in that case, I guess I just wanted to comment that although I think it's really interesting that the hypothesis-driven approach you took to considering scenarios, just to comment that as a caveat, some of those scenarios are probably not feasible to isolate stocks as a management response.
Yeah, I agree. And we have also results for a coast-wide abundance also, right?
Oh, okay.
And they didn't generate the largest effect.
Okay.
But we are working now on including those on a more thorough basis.
Okay.
Scenario 4 you have up there.
Yes.
Am I correct in understanding that was the one where you're going to shut down the Puget Sound fishery?
You know, scenario 4 is 75% reductions on ocean harvest rate occurring on Puget Sound stocks. 75% reductions on the ocean harvest rates.
So
the one that we shut down everything.
You sort of put that into mind what we heard this morning, that most of the diet was Fraser River stocks, and you're showing by putting more Puget Sound fish into the system, that results in a slower rate of decline.
Are you referring to the scenario 2? Let me increase this.
Scenario 4 in the,
oh, because
the top panel there. You have probably 0.262 compared to the other ones.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm just wondering how you tied in Puget Sound fish to this. Is it just total abundance overall?
I'm not sure about that.
I'm just not understanding how you separated the stocks out to drive the model.
Well, when we start analyzing the during the regression analysis, right, trying to correlate vital rates with different aggregations of stocks, right? Some of those aggregations were upon based on this hypothesis 1A and 1B, for which we have evidence for causation, and then 2A and 2B, for which we don't have that evidence. And some of these can be just, I mean, we cannot defend causation there.
Peter?
Well, I guess I'm also confused by the scenarios.
Who's talking there?
I'm sorry, I'm here.
Oh,
I'm sorry. I'm confused particularly by 2 and 4.
Let me bring the other slide that has only the scenarios, just that we can see.
Yeah, we'll need to wrap up fairly soon, so.
So I read 2 to be, you're concerned about the terminal run size of Fraser and Puget Sound stocks, so no ocean fishing on those stocks.
Mm-hmm.
And I read scenario 4 to be you're focusing on Puget Sound stocks and you're wanting to get a 75% reduction of ocean harvest rates on that stock.
Mm-hmm.
That seems to be less restrictive Puget Sound than scenario 2.
Good point.
And yet the effect in parameter, but there was a much more substantial effect in 4 than 2.
And thanks for bringing that up, because maybe I wasn't that clear linking that with information in the last column, right, where we see the effect on the vital rates, right? If you see the 75% reduction on ocean harvest of Puget Sound produce a maximization of the corresponding vital rate, which in this case was survival of young and old reproductive females here, right? So this is saying that any increase, I mean, going beyond 75% gives you exactly the same maximization. So in this case, we achieve a maximization of this rate by this scenario. In these other cases, even we maximize the effect, we don't maximize the vital rate. We increase those vital rates substantially, but they don't reach the maximum. Yeah. And of course, the maximum for survival is going to be 1. So that's why one maximizes the effect of the fishery, and the other one seems like it's maximizing the effect on the vital rates. Right? It's just reaching the roof of the effect.
We're gonna need to wrap this up quickly. So if you have a very quick question, that's okay. If it's a longer question, you'll need to head the coffee table.
Sorry.
Could you go to your second to last slide? I think it is.
Second?
Second to last.
Oh.
Basically, I find this a little troubling in that we are obviously having... Yes. What you have identified are additional study needs. And I think perhaps the best we can do at this outcome is to identify that which we still need to know, because we've come up with conclusions that are polar opposite in our observation, and this is under the best studied population in the world with some of the best data for even the demographic, not only demographics, but for the environmental effects. So I am concerned that we've been getting funding to do studies on this population even before it was listed, and our ability to continue to get funding for this population will be predicated on being able to at least draw some kind of conclusions about something as basic as either, you know, food or sex is the two most important questions to ask of a population. So I would ask that the science panel could, I would suggest that the science panel could do a great service in being able to give guidance to NOAA, who has their own, you know, internal politics, as to what studies should be prioritized with attention to the fact that we need to address specific questions in a way that's of minimal invasiveness, so that our studies themselves do not contribute to their decline, and that are cost-effective, because we need to be able to continue to study this population into the future. Obviously, the conclusions are not forthcoming. Thank you.
So that's a great segue,
because the panel discussion, the third question that they're going to be, not the science panel, but the workshop three panel, the third question are
is, what are the most critical data needs and required analyses to reduce key uncertainties affecting management decisions? So hopefully each of the panelists will be able to get to that. So what I'd like to do now is ask the panel members to come forward. And first of all, thanks, Antonio. So we have Dave Bernard from Last Park Fisher Games, Scott Pearson, John Ford, Eric Ward, Jim Irvine. I gave some context this morning. I think the first thing is all the panelists are being asked to look at evidence for and against. This is not a sort of debate where you prove the other guy wrong. We're trying to all act as neutral scientists. Part of the problem